Tonight on Arena, we preview Hugh Lane, Sarah Green and an all-star cast in the BBC's Roadkill, and John O'Connor on the final piano sonatas of Ludwig van Beethoven. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. This year, 2020, we mark the 250th anniversary of composer Ludwig van Beethoven's birth, and as part of the year-long celebration, Music for Galway will stage a special concert tomorrow featuring the renowned pianist John O'Connor performing the composer's final three piano sonatas. These works were to be performed before a live audience in Galway, but given the world in which we now live, the performance will be streamed live from the concert venue in the centre of Galway City tomorrow evening. And delighted to say that I'm joined by John O'Connor now from our Galway studio. Strange times that we live in, for sure, John. Were you disappointed when you heard that it was going to be streamed rather than with an audience there in front of you?
Well, to be quite honest, I mean, I haven't done a live concert. I haven't done any concert since the beginning of March. So this is the first concert I'm giving. I'm giving three concerts in Ireland: Galway tomorrow night, and Drogheda on Friday, and Belfast next week. And it's a relief to be actually playing to anything at all, even if the people are not sitting in the audience, because it's been an incredibly depressing time. Mm. I mean, as you saw, one concert after another being cancelled, and not a single one. I mean, I should have been giving about, I think, 65 concerts this year of Beethoven, and I've had nothing since March, as I say.
It's so difficult to deal with. And I mean, we've spoken to so many artists about this. But I guess, you know, I do wonder to a certain extent, John, about if you're streaming it live, if you have to play it in front of a live audience, albeit not sitting in the auditorium in front of you, but out there, it's not as if you can fluff something and say, ah, no, I'll just go back in that little bit. You still have to do what you would do in a live situation.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it's the pressure's on you. I mean, you're playing to one cameraman, I think. That's about it. I'm not even sure. I haven't done any of these before. So tomorrow night will be my first experience. But I believe it's just one cameraman in the room. And so you're playing to him. So you just hope that he's receptive and doesn't go for a smoke in the middle of it or something like that.
There might be a few people watching what the cameraman is sending out to us as well.
That'd be nice.
I would guess. The final three piano sonatas of Beethoven is what you're giving us tomorrow night, John. We have 32 in total. When he comes to those final three, what has he managed to achieve across, never mind all the other work he's done, but just that body of piano works?
I studied with the great German pianist Wilhelm Kempff, and when he did his course in the summer, he would start at the very beginning, the first sonata, Opus 2, number 1, and go straight through chronologically to the last three. And you suddenly realise for the first time what he did achieve. I mean, from being, you know, almost the student of Haydn and in the same sort of style of Haydn and Mozart, even though he was already developing his own voice, as it were. But what he achieved through his whole life and how the pianos changed in his lifetime. I mean, when Haydn was writing, it was still the harpsichord or the forte pianos. Mm. And for the beginning, Beethoven had the forte pianos, and his piano wasn't as wide as it is now. Now we have 88 keys, he had about 65. And all the time he railed against the pianos and saying they weren't good enough. So he would love the modern day Steinway. And yeah. He was already composing sort of, you know, by the time certainly he got to the last three sonatas, he was composing for the piano that would appear eventually, which we now have.
And I guess it's one of the big differences there. Obviously, I suppose the resonance of the instrument has changed. But one of the big things that is the name itself, piano forte, you can now, the dynamics, the loudness, the softness, you can play much more in a much more graduated fashion than you could have done on earlier pianos or in Beethoven's time.
Absolutely. And I mean, I remember being in the Beethoven house in Bonn and being allowed to play the piano that he actually composed the Waldstein Sonata on. And it was so light and it was so easy. I mean, there's the end of the Waldstein Sonata, you're supposed to glissando with the thumb and fifth finger, which in a modern day piano can almost break your fingers because they're so difficult to get down. But in those days, you could just slide down them and they were the easiest thing. But so life has changed a lot for us pianists, but we're not complaining. It's great pianos we have now.
Yeah, and I suppose what you lose in the roundabouts, you gain on the swings. And if you have a sore finger, you have a much nicer sound for the sore finger.
That's true. And more variety too.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. When did you actually first perform Beethoven, John? Can you remember back to that first public performance?
First public performance, my goodness. I would have been about 16 or 17. Mm. I studied with Dr. J.J. O'Reilly in the College of Music in Dublin. He was a great teacher and a great inspirer. He talked about dreams, about how you could walk on stage and do concerts. And I believed all the dreams. And, you know, it happened for me. But, I mean, when I was about 16 or 17, he said to me, "You're ready now to play your first Beethoven sonata." And very cleverly, he gave me a very slim book about Beethoven's life. He said, "If you want to play Beethoven, you need to know the man." And there was a story in that I remember which just attracted me so much to the man in a certain peculiar way, in the sense that I was a well brought up Dublin boy. I mean, my father made me stand up for ladies in a bus and open the doors for ladies and all that sort of thing. And there was a story in it of Beethoven and Goethe walking in the Mödling outside Vienna, and the imperial party came along with all these princesses in their long dresses. So Goethe stepped into the dirty road so that the princess dresses wouldn't get dirty, and Beethoven walked straight through them and said, "My genius bows to no man." And I remember reading that and thinking, that's disgraceful, that's disgusting, that's awful. And yet it was sort of, that's kind of interesting. So I had to know more about him. So I did read more and I played a lot more and that sort of thing, which brought me to him more and more. I mean, I was about 10 when I heard my elder sister Carmel was doing her teaching diploma, and she played the Opus 110 sonata, the second last sonata. And I just fell in love with the slow movement. It was one of the most tragic musical moments I'd ever heard in my life. And even though it was written in six flats, which is very difficult to sight read, particularly for a 10-year-old, I had to sit down and try and struggle through it, because it just touched my heart and it was just amazing. And
you're telling
me
that as a 10-year-old you had a go at sonata number 31?
Only the bits I could vaguely play. I mean, most of it I couldn't get around at all. But those bits I could play, I had a go at. I had to.
Let's have a little listen to the opening section of sonata number 31, A flat major, all those flat, as you say. The performer here is Stephen Osborne. So delicate, I'm almost afraid to talk over it. Just the opening section there of the sonata number 31 in A flat major, one of the three pieces that John O'Connor will be performing tomorrow as part of Music for Galway. You get a sense listening to that, John, just how delicate. There's a real sense of introspection, a real sadness actually in even that opening section, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And it's like he's searching for a key. I mean, he's going through all sorts of different keys. He's searching for something, and it moves on and on. And then this incredible melody comes in the right hand, which is, as I say, heartbreaking. It's just extraordinary.
You mentioned that, you know, getting to know the man, even as when you started out with one of those, I presume, early sonatas that you were given by your teacher, but maybe not. Maybe it was a later one, but I would guess it was an early one.
Yeah.
That you wanted to learn more about the man. Now, tomorrow's concert, and in fact, there's a symposium as well, is in memory of Emily Anderson, a professor of German in NUI Galway. She translated some of the letters of Beethoven. Are there things that he says in there and things that you find from her writings that have opened up these late sonatas, these final three sonatas, in new ways to you?
Yes, I mean, just reading his life at this part of his life, how difficult it was for him. I mean, well, you have to realise with Beethoven's life, he set out to become the greatest pianist in the world. And in his 20s, he probably was. And then he started losing his hearing. So by the age of 30, he realised he was going deaf, which for any musician is just a death knell. I mean, and when he was 32, he wrote what's called now the Heiligenstadt Testament, which was basically a suicide note. Fortunately, he didn't send it, and it wasn't discovered until after he died. But it was basically saying, you know, what am I doing on this life? What is this life if I can't have music? And then he had a great belief in the Almighty. He realised, you know, if God put me on this earth for a reason, obviously it's not to become the greatest pianist in the world. Maybe it's the greatest composer, or certainly to compose more. So he composed more and more and more all the way through his life. And when you read his letters, you realise the anguish he was going through in so many ways. I mean, all sorts of things that were in his life that make you realise that when you hear music like the Opus 110, that it's his heart coming straight out onto the music, and has to, you have to actually go beyond what's written on the page to understand what it was coming from. In other words, how he heard it in his head, even though he couldn't hear it in person, even.
And I guess that's all work, that's work that you could do since last March, because you weren't playing in public. All that work has to be really, I suppose, absorbed into the head well before any concerts and anything like that. And then you just let it filter through rather than trying to actively put it into play on certain phrases or notes or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been playing the Opus 110. It was part of my programme when I won the Beethoven competition in 1973, which is almost 50 years ago now. So I sort of know it pretty well. But,
yes.
You know, it constantly at the same time, every time you play it, you can find something new. You never get tired of Beethoven. You never do, because there's so much in there. If you listen to it in a different way, in a different place, and at a different time, you'll hear something that you've never heard before.
And you've recorded all 32 of the sonatas, of course. Have you ever performed them in, you know, the sort of chronology that you spoke about, that your early teachers talked to you about, you know, going through the sonatas in that order, what you see? Have you performed them in a way that has opened up the chronology of them and how you see that development, or does that just come from 50 years of playing them?
No, the first time I did the complete cycle was in the National Concert Hall in Dublin in 84-85, and I did them all 32 in the season. And then after that, I did them in New York and in Boston in 89, and then I've played them quite a few times since then. I did them again in the National Concert Hall in 2004-2005, and it was funny, at that stage I said to Judy Woodworth, who was the head of the National Concert Hall at the time, I said, Judy, I know these pieces so well, I want to talk about them before I play the programme and just give hints so people can understand them better. And she said, fine, when will you do it, a week beforehand? And I said, no, I'd like to talk at 7 o'clock, take a break at 7:30 and then play the concert at 8. She said, oh, you'd be too tired. And I said, that's what I want to do. So she said, all right, I don't think many people will come, but however. So the first concert, you know, she called me a week beforehand and said, well, OK, I thought we would have it in the director's salon, which can take 80 people, but we've already got 150 people signed up. So can we do it in the main concert hall? And I said, sure. So for the first recital, there were 8 recitals in all. Hmm. For the first recital, there were about 250 people there. And then suddenly word got out. And by the time I was doing the 8th recital, there were over 700 people in the hall at 7 o'clock to hear me talking. And about a week later, I was walking down Kildare Street in Dublin, and a man stopped me and said, John O'Connor. And I thought, oh gosh, somebody else whose face I don't recognise anymore. And I'm terrible at remembering people's names. I'll talk to anybody if they reintroduce themselves. But anyway, he said, it's all right, you don't know me, but I was at your concert, I was at your lectures. I only discovered them for the third time. And he talked to me for about 15 minutes about the lectures and how wonderful it was and how it opened his mind to Beethoven more. And I said, great. And he was turning away to go away. And I said to him, how was the playing? And he said, oh, that was fine. And then he just turned around and left.
But I'm really surprised to hear that you, as I'm sure Judy Woodward was as well, that you had agreed to speak before playing. Surely the type of pressure that you're under when you're performing pieces of this magnitude, it's phenomenal to take time out to have a chat with the audience beforehand. Or did that help you getting into the pieces?
I think it helped me, and I think it helped them. And remember, I've been playing these pieces for 50 years. So,
yeah.
I mean, they're old friends at this stage. And I like to share, I mean, the people will know some of the sonatas very well, like the Moonlight or the Pathetique, which are very famous. But there are a lot of sonatas that they won't know at all. And I want to say, listen for this and listen for this and wait till you hear how he does this and that sort of thing, which people find kept on coming up to me after and saying, that was fascinating. I've never loved that sonata before. I'm going out to get a recording of it tomorrow.
Yeah, and you'll be talking with Finian Collins about the sonatas tomorrow. But I think that's after the event, isn't it?
Yes, yes, we're doing a talk. Well, we're doing a symposium first, and then we have a 45-minute talk, Finian and I, about Beethoven. And then after the recital, I'm doing a question and answers with him.
Oh, so all of the symposium and the chat will be beforehand, and then the recital, and then the Q&A after the event. Well, of course,
yeah.
people can ask questions, I suppose. Having listened, they can ask questions about what they've just been listening to. What about the sonatas versus the concerti? The Beethoven piano concertos are pretty important as well. Which of your children do you like better? Is that the question I'm asking here, or which are better, apples or oranges?
And well, that's a little bit that way, yes. I mean, people often ask me which one, and I sometimes say, you know, the one I'm playing at the time, because you love it. But I suppose my favourite of all the concertos is number 3, and then number 5. But at the same time, number 4 has a special place in my heart because it's what I played at the final of the Beethoven competition when I won first prize, which really started my international career. So that has something very special for me.
Piano. Piano composition, there were other concerti as well, obviously, for violin in particular. There, we have the string quartets and we have the big symphonies. What could Beethoven not do?
He wasn't a great composer for voice. He was great for instrumentalists of all sorts, but he sometimes forgot the fact that singers have to actually not sing the high notes non-stop. So I remember talking to one girl who could actually sing the soprano part of the Ninth Symphony really well until it got to a certain place where she said, he leaves you hanging up there on the top notes for so long, your voice just cracks after a while sometimes. So you have to be very, very careful. So, you know, he wrote some beautiful songs, there's no doubt about it. But he wasn't as good, let's say, as Schubert or Schumann or Brahms or something, one of those, at voice.
Of course, and there was only one opera in there as well, which I suppose tells its own story as well. Well, listen, John, lovely to speak with you this evening, and lovely that you are getting back on stage tomorrow, albeit in that that there won't be an audience there, but there will be out in the ether, believe me.
That's the
way we work every night. You know, they are there and they will be listening.
Well, it's all available on the Music for Galway website. They'll know exactly how to clock in.
Yeah, well, listen, I'll give the full information on that
in a couple of minutes'
time.
That's very good of you.
Thanks, John. But let's finish up by listening to one of the brighter section of the Sonata No. 30, the first of the three that John O'Connor will be playing tomorrow night, the opening of Sonata No. 30. Opening there of Sonata No. 30 in E major, the Opus 109 of Ludwig van Beethoven. One of the three pieces that John O'Connor will be playing tomorrow night, Anders Schief, the performer in that recording that we played for you there. But for more information on registering for the Zoom symposium and to view the stream of John O'Connor's performance from the Hardiman Hotel in Galway online tomorrow night, you can visit musicforgalway.ie. A link for the performance costs a mere €12. Now, that is a treat. 3 piano sonatas from John O'Connor for just €12. A bargain, I would have thought.